So should I put this up in the Okay, just to follow on from Nandita, my name is Aziz Chaudhry. I'm based in Aotearoa, New Zealand, but what I'm mainly going to focus on now is talking about Australia. And I should say that that's not because of any real sense that the situation in New Zealand is so much better, because in fact there's a bit of a US-Canada thing often with a lot of talk about policy issues and things like that, that sometimes liberal people in Canada say, oh, well, we're so much better than US, and likewise in New Zealand there's that sort of tendency as well. But I guess one of the questions that I wanted to start off asking was, whose borders are they anyway? Because when Nandita was involved with organising Open the Borders in Vancouver, I was at a small meeting in Adelaide in Australia called Borderlines just before a big mobilisation against the concentration camp in the desert for people who have come in. And I've used the word concentration camp. It's not a throwaway line. That's what they are. These are a subsidiary of Wackenhut, ACM, Australasian Correctional Management, that runs private detention centres for people that are entering into Australia without papers. Anyway, just here are a couple of cartoons that were done. This one was done the top one here was done in 1988, which was the year that White Australia celebrated its bicentennial. And you have two Indigenous people standing on the shore there saying, oh no, international terrorists. And there's some people down the front there on the shore with a boat in the background planting a flag. I'm not sure. Do you recognise that flag? It's got, I think it's, I think they call it Union Jack, yeah. But anyway, the people that plant it, the people that used to go around the world and plant it, and they said, well, everything that I can see, I will claim for king or queen, someone or other. And this one down here was one that was done more recently, which relates to what's going on now and links, I guess, back to the fact that Australia, like Canada and Aotearoa New Zealand, is a white settler colonial state. And you have an Indigenous guy here saying to somebody else with that thing again, that jack of all trades thing, saying, I'm afraid this state-of-the-art olfactory tracking device is mandatory until your refugee status can be assessed. With this kind of rotting sheep carcass on this colonizer's head, and it's kind of, I guess, in terms of some of the work that I've done as an activist that's worked on Indigenous sovereignty issues, as an activist that also has roots back in South Asia, and as an activist that works on corporate globalization, is to be looking at, I guess, some of the connections and some of the links in the different, well, what may seem to be different campaigns, but in fact I think are intimately linked. And I was showing Jaggi Singh earlier this thing that I brought up from a New Zealand newspaper, which is Boat People Invade Australia. You know, this article came out last year, but it was about 200 and something years too late, because, you know, I'm not going to quote Celine Dion, honestly. I know when I come here, my Canadian friends get really into my obsession with Celine Dion and bad Canadian music. But I will quote a very good Indigenous Australian activist, singer-songwriter, Kev Carmody, who said in 1788 down Sydney Cove, I won't sing it, the first boat people landed. They said, sorry boys, your gains are lost, we're going to steal your land. And so I find it really interesting now looking at what's going on in Australia with not only with the policy of mandatory detention for people that are coming into Australia from countries like Iraq, from Afghanistan and so on, and their so-called Pacific solution, which I'll talk about in a minute, by trying to get countries in the Pacific that are now essentially being used as these kind of dumping grounds for unwanted people, like Nauru, like Papua New Guinea. I find it very interesting watching these people who are essentially creating this sort of, as Nandita was saying, about this sort of construct of the nation being the white Australian nation, suddenly deciding who can come in and out of, well, not that they're suddenly deciding it, this has been going on for a long time, but giving themselves the right to decide who comes in and who goes out and who gets to be deemed to be Australian or assimilatable enough to come into the country. And I guess to me it seems to me that there's a similar dynamic here in terms of Canada, in terms of this whole arrogance of coloniser settler governments, which is what they still are, to actually say, we can do all this stuff and anyway, not even discuss, not even make any acknowledgement of the fact that the land and the resources that these governments are also benefiting from is stolen. And that's it, plain and simple. This is stolen land. Australia is stolen land. Aotearoa New Zealand is stolen land. And the US too is stolen land. So I find it really, that's a kind of an irony to begin with. And I think that in that, there is also some opportunities for some of us that do come from or have our background in other places in third world or whatever, to actually be looking at some of the alliances and some of the commonalities among our struggles, both whether they're within the societies we're living in or looking at the dynamics that are impacting on the societies that maybe our families have moved from, and looking at alliances with Indigenous people, because I think there have been some really quite interesting stuff that's happened in Australia where we've seen prominent Aboriginal activists saying, this, looking at the concentration camps for the people that are being held there, and saying, this is exactly the way we have been treated for the last 200 years, and we are just like these people in here, essentially. And actually, there's been some good outspoken people that have said, that have actually come out and said some very important things, I think, in making those connections. I should also stress too, and I think this is also relevant to the Canadian situation, that the current system of mandatory detention in Australia came in under a so-called centre-left government. It came in 1992. It was the Labor government that brought that in. It's not something that's happened since September 11. It's something that has been going on for a long time. And I know here sometimes there's this sort of dynamic here about kind of, the NDP will fix everything. And certainly, it seems to me that, there's a saying, if you'll excuse my terribly vulgar language, same shit, different piles, basically, in terms of how this has been approached. And it's also interesting looking at in 92, the fact that same year when Australia was looking at recession, there was unemployment growing, you had, on the one hand, this mandatory detention scheme, mandatory detention for people that didn't come in with papers being set up, and all of these what are now privately run, Wack and Hut subsidiary owned and run camps in the desert, in the outback, in areas extremely, so-called inhospitable. At the same time you saw an increasing embrace by Australia and advocacy for free trade and free investment, as they call it. And it's very, I've just been looking at some of this stuff recently, on one level, Australian foreign affairs and trade policy, where they're looking at engagement with the Indian Ocean Rim countries, and on the other hand, looking at how they treat people that are coming in from Indian Ocean Rim countries who arrive there without documentation. And then also how that flows on to the communities that already exist in Australia of people that come from those countries, especially obviously since September 11. Last time I was in Montreal, I talked to the South Asian Women's Community Centre here about the sort of the, I don't really want to call it backlash, but the what had happened basically in the Pacific and in Australia and New Zealand in relation to the sort of the September 11 events. And what had happened just prior to my coming up and prior to September 11 had been that a Norwegian freighter called the Tampa, and I don't know if people are familiar with this story, I'm not really aware of the level of coverage and so on that has been there, was intercepted by the Australian Navy. The Australian Armed Forces now, you know what their functions are? Apart from going over to Afghanistan and fighting with all the other forces that are there, with Tony Blair's mob and George Bush's mob and Chretien's mob that seems to be digging up graves and being really excited about finding, you know, dead bodies at the moment and so on. What the Navy's function is basically patrolling the Indian Ocean coast and keeping out people that are trying to come in, mainly from Indonesia, on boats. And I mean, it's a really serious military operation. And these Navy people are also backed up by the SAS, the Special Armed Service people. There have been reports of people being beaten up, brutalised by Australian armed forces, which, of course, are strenuously denied. And so even before September 11, you had a boatload of mainly Afghani people that are coming in, and you already had this sort of paranoia and this whipping up of this sentiment against these people, as they're called. They're called these people. This is what people are referred to now, is just these people that the politicians talk about. And the entire election in November last year in Australia was won. Seriously, the so-called asylum seeker issue was what John Howard's government won the election on. And again, if you look at the Labor opposition, they were just essentially arm wrestling to say who could be tougher, who is going to be tougher with these people, who is going to be meaner and show the world that Australia was not a soft touch for these people smugglers and these people that are coming in. And again, like Nandita's saying, there's been a lot of focus on this people smuggling in Australia. They've been talking about queue jumpers, the people that are coming in. And really, it's a in the global context, what Australia, the number of people going into Australia is just nothing. I mean, you know, I've been in Pakistan, I've seen the numbers, and this is going years ago, the numbers of people that are in refugee camps that have been there for a year. And suddenly, the West has only just discovered, it seems, in the last few years, last few months, that, oh, there's all these millions of people in Pakistan and Iran. And so when you hear words like, you know, boat people invading Australia, and when you hear about invasion, and even Philip Ruddock, the Minister for Multicultural Affairs, Immigration and Indigenous Affairs, which is kind of an interesting mix. He's the guy that is one of the main players, I guess, in terms of this politically there. And when you hear him talking about words like national emergency, which is a word that he used in 1999 to describe the numbers of people coming in, you can see just how this is really being hyped up, because the reality is, of course, geographically, compared with the numbers of people that are able to get to Europe and to North America and so on, Australia is not getting anything like an invasion of people. Then, of course, there is a real... I think there's a really interesting issue if we're looking at sort of the specifics to Australia. It's ironic that in the 1860s, the British brought out people from what's modern-day Afghanistan, India, Middle East, to open up the outback, the camel herders. Now, a lot of Australians don't even know this history. It's sort of been written out of the history books until recently. And when I was in Adelaide 6 weeks ago, and down at the railway station in Adelaide, I saw the GAN, as they call it in Australia, the GAN. Now, the GAN is short for Afghan. And this is the train that runs from the GAN, runs from Adelaide to Alice Springs, and essentially that is that for want of a better. I mean, that's essentially been how in many the only sort of legacy that for of that whole history, forgotten history of what essentially people from that part of the world did for the Australian nation, as it was. It's kind of interesting now, you know, how that kind of gets forgotten too. And in fact, again, looking at sort of continuity towards the old style, you know, I mean, this idea that things have just, I mean, yeah, September 11 obviously has intensified things and given governments chances to bring in legislation and do all kinds of things, but let's not kid ourselves that this was anything that wasn't happening before. Australia had a white Australia policy, then it had an assimilation policy. In the 1990s, it thought multiculturalism was kind of a cool way to get their goods into economies in Asia and saying, hey, we're a multicultural society. Yeah, we like Asian people sometimes. Well, you know, we like it, you know, when we have this kind of festival in Sydney or something, it's kind of neat having, you know, some people doing some singing and dancing and stuff, and there's some really nice Lebanese food down the road here too and that. So, yeah. But now, since 96, that's kind of changed a little bit. That dynamic has changed a little bit in the sense that they have gone, if you like, because of the Conservative government, they have kind of backed off this sort of, you know, we are part of Asia, which I think Paul Keating, the Labor Prime Minister, talked about in the early 1990s. But they've got this great initiative called Supermarket to Asia. Now, what they're Supermarket to Asia? They want a supermarket to Asia, but they don't want people that are coming in from Asian countries that are often leaving as a result of regimes that Australia either has in the past or still does support. They don't want that. So there's always that kind of conflict, I guess, between when you look at the economic policies and you look at the rhetoric about open borders and you look at the rhetoric about, you know, global village and all this, when it comes down to it, you know, there's nothing of the sort. But last year, I mean, there are any number of disgusting examples of how outright lies have been told by politicians to essentially sort of build up this fear of invasion, this invasion paranoia. And I think, again, the invasion paranoia can be linked back to the fact that, yes, white settlers in Australia are invaders themselves. I think there is something in the colonial white settler psyche, if you like, that does have a bearing on this. And in the 1890s, there was a journalist who was giving evidence to Western Australia's parliament about the Afghan problem. I get my accents right. My accents are mixed up, it's not funny. Afghan problem. Gilbert Probyn Smith, he said in 1894, the problem was because there were Afghans that were taking food into the food supply chains into this gold rush area called Coolgardie in Western Australia. And he said, yeah, the problem is that many were still in sympathy with those Afghans who fought the British during the Second Afghan War. They were traitorous by nature. And he warned of the peril, this is a direct quote, he warned of the peril to Australian lives if a jihad were to be proclaimed somewhere in the Muslim world. And now, you know, just last year, the Defence Minister in Australia, Peter Reith, he claimed that the unauthorised arrival of boats on Australian territory, quote, can be a pipeline for terrorists to come in and use your country as a staging post for terrorist activities. And so along with all of this, sort of stuff, there's also been the equivalent of CSIS, the Asian Security Intelligence Organisation, the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service in New Zealand, that have been going into communities that they decide are, you know, somehow going to be national security threats, and we can all guess who they're going to be. And you know, they don't tend to go to the overstayers from Britain and Canada and the States, who tend to be actually the numerical majority in those countries of people who are so-called overstayers. Because if you read the government line on immigration, they say that, I mean, there's this thing I got from the Australian Ministry of Immigration. It says here that all unlawful non-citizens who are in Australia must be detained. And unless they are granted permission to remain on Australia, they must be removed from Australia as soon as practicable. But when you look at Woomera and you look at Curtin and you look at all of the other detention centres, so-called, in Australia, it's funny, but they're not full of British people or Canadians or, you know, Americans, even though if you want to take that analysis, those people have always been the people, as far as, you know, overstayers, as far as visas go, have been the overstayers in that. The visitors from those countries, and so, yeah, I mean, there's been that. There's also been a lot of resistance that I think it's really important to note that that has come from inside the centres and not just outside the centres, because a lot of the liberal groups in Australia present this kind of thing that, oh, they're organising, they're concerned about the refugees being treated this way. But in fact, like I think somebody was saying this morning about, you know, maybe in States or Canada as well, you know, there's been resistance from the word go. I mean, those people have been actively playing a role in their in seeking a safer life, a better life for them and their families, and to construct them as they've been done by both sometimes people on the left and the right as being kind of, you know, passive victims or kind of that need our help sort of thing, or kind of, you know, evil sleepers for Al-Qaeda or whatever the latest stereotype is, then that's nonsensical. And so recently, over Easter, in Woomera, which is in the South Australian desert, there was a major mobilisation. Friends of mine were involved with organising this convergence on Woomera, which is one of the biggest detention centres there. And they basically, people from inside and outside, brought down some of the fences. And to my knowledge, as of when I left, there were still 12 people who had been held inside that concentration camp who were, who'd basically been whisked to safety outside. They're still out, and hopefully, will still stay out, because there were a lot of people were able to escape and get out. And I mean, the conditions in those camps are absolutely disgusting. You have this same, and again, going back to Australia's colonial sort of history, you have this obsession with locking people up if they're a certain kind of people. And Australia at the moment is locking up a hell of a lot of people that are coming in, either in Australian territory, or now what they're trying to do is say, no, if you land on Australia, you can't actually claim any kind of status in Australia. You're not going to have you here. You'll go off to Manus Island in Papua New Guinea, which is an old Papua New Guinea Navy base, which the Australian College of Physicians put out a media release about a couple of months ago, saying this is outrageous that people are being kept here where there's a very dangerous and high risk of contracting malaria, where people have been lied to. Basically, people have thought they were going to Australia. They found out they're actually imprisoned on a Pacific island away from anywhere. We've already got countries like Papua New Guinea that are suffering under structural adjustment policies that have been dumped on by Australia and New Zealand in the sort of the junior subcontractor kind of role that they play for Western imperialism in the South Pacific, where you have already internally issues of displaced people with the West Papuan refugees, who Australia always used to take this line that West Papuan refugees weren't, you know, this is all an internal dispute inside of Indonesia. The West Papuan community activists, some of the independence activists came out, and they spoke very strongly about, in support of the people that were coming in from Afghanistan and Iraq. But they also pointed out the fact that, you know, Australia had taken this line in the Pacific when activists from the Pacific independence struggles had been forced to flee their countries, and that often they were just, you know, put on a terrorist kind of blacklist and weren't able to come in. And so that resistance and that movement, I think, in Australia is quite similar. There are some quite similar strands in terms of the sort of the open borders discussions that are taking place there. Back in New Zealand, where I live, the issue is kind of because of the demographics, it's quite different in terms of the numbers relatively of people coming in. If you look at the numbers, you think, oh, it's not very much. But remember, we're talking about a country of 3.9 million people. And still, if you come into New Zealand and you don't have papers, you get locked up. If they catch you, you get locked up in Mount Eden Prison, which is this Victorian shambles, which is just a disgusting, you know, hole, or put into a secure unit in the Mangere Reception Centre for the Refugee and Migrant Reception Centre in South Auckland. And again, there has been that, and again, like somebody was saying yesterday, I think it's wrong to use the term backlash, because it assumes that people from South Asian or Muslim communities have actually done anything to be, you know, lashed against. There has been, a part and parcel of whipping up all of this hatred and hysteria around the sort of the so-called invasion of the asylum seekers has been that there has been a backlash against communities that have been there for a long time, you know, you hear lots of stories, or the same kind of stories that we hear in the States, of Sikh taxi drivers getting hassled, mosques getting graffitied and targeted. There were two mosques, I think, that were one was burned down in Brisbane, and I think there was another arson attack. Kids getting hassled on the way to school, and so that flow over into, if you like, the established good, you know, immigrants that have been trying to fit in to Australia and New Zealand society and so on. Suddenly, you know, we're all kind of like suspect, sleepers for whoever it is, Bin Laden or something like that. I actually think that that's, it's a real thing. Somebody was saying yesterday, it's like a slap in the face for a lot of, longer standing immigrant communities, that suddenly they realised, they thought they'd been accepted and it was okay and all that, and suddenly, you know, it's comments at work or it's jokes about, you know, Bin Laden, or it's, you know, kind of something worse than that, obviously the what's been happening in the States with the disappearances, that sort of stuff that's been going down, and again, I think that goes back to some of the stuff that Nandita was talking about, the constructs of, you know, the nation state, I think, you know, we have to look at to the links and the connections between immigration in all of its forms and colonisation, because immigration and colonisation have always gone, have always been kind of things, part and parcel of they've been very, very related. Whether you're looking at getting so-called cheap labour into Western countries, and who benefit, you know, all of the questions about who benefits and so on, or whether you're looking at the way that countries or dominant, you know, governments kind of construct and perpetuate their kind of image of themselves. And it's interesting, just on the plane up from Australia and from New Zealand, I'll just sort of finish with this. Philip Ruddock, who seems to be big on declaring what is and isn't Australian, because he has said various things about people that have been coming in from Iraq and Afghanistan, this is very un-Australian behaviour. When there have been protests within the detention centres, this is very un-Australian. When the Australian government completely fabricated the claims that children were thrown overboard, Iraqi asylum seekers were throwing kids overboard a boat last year, it was totally fabricated and essentially helped them win the election. He was saying, "Oh, this is un-Australian," and John Howard, the Prime Minister, was saying, "Oh, yeah, I mean, this is just, you know, we wouldn't do that sort of stuff here." And when people who had been on hunger strike were sewing their lips together because this was one way they could make sure they weren't going to be force-fed and so on, when they were on hunger strike inside the Curtin centres and some of these other detention centres, again, you had all this un-Australian stuff and all of this rubbish that was saying somehow this was implying this was a cultural practice. I mean, for God's sake, which culture in the world is going to do that, unless there's something really desperate and really a very serious situation going on. Ruddock announced that next year they're going to have this big immigration push, and they're going to have 105,000 target for bringing in new migrants into Australia. They'll keep the refugee numbers at 12,000, which is their standard quota. And it'll be really interesting to see what the breakdown of that 105,000 new immigrants is, where they come from, how much money they bring in, and on what base, you know, essentially what basis that they come in. Because there was this, and I don't know if it's been the same here, there's been this thing recently, you know, the Commonwealth had its circus, that Chogham meeting in Brisbane a few weeks ago, and, you know, I don't know what Canada's position was, but Australia and New Zealand were going, "Oh, you know, Zimbabwe, you know, really bad human rights, and we like human rights in our country, so we should kick Mugabe out," and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not going to sit here and defend Mugabe, but it's, you know, you have this total hypocrisy on the part of these governments that are instituting the same repressive legislation, anti-terrorist legislation, immigration kinds of legislation, and on the other hand, you have this lobby within Australia and New Zealand, and coming from quite significant sectors in big business at some stage, saying, oh yeah, but we should let the white farmers from Zimbabwe come in under refugee status. It's outrageous that these people don't come in, because you know these people, you know, they would fit in really well in a country like New Zealand or Australia. But the irony, of course, is a lot of these people are actually coming in as business migrants. They can come in as business migrants. They don't need to come in as refugees then. And in fact, in Australia and New Zealand, frankly, there are enough, if you like, homegrown racists there, without more of these. Although we have a fair quota of South African cops, you know, there are a few of them around, and a couple of ex-RUC guys have arrested me and stuff like that. You know, we have that sort of international flavour in the police force too. So there is this sort of thing. We had one MP going, well, the Somalis shouldn't be here because they're desert races and they don't fit in. But he was the same guy that was actually sort of making a case, I think, that the white farmers in Zimbabwe, I think they're like the real Africans or something, is that right? That the Zimbabwe white farmers are the real Africans, and everybody that's really African isn't really African or something like that. I think that's how it works these days. So, yeah. But anyway, I've kind of skipped all over the place, but I wanted to sort of give a sense of, I guess, some of the dynamics and some of the things that are being discussed and some of the things that are happening there. I've got sort of information that, I mean, if people can, I'm happy to talk about it too, and I've got other stuff with me that I'd be happy to sort of share with people. So, anyway, thanks.